This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
All those things that I was giving about a surrounding for meaningful scenes, I didn't mean that you were going to dig the poem by knowing those things. I was trying to give some idea of the process and the writing of the poem. It's a fascinating job to unwind the process of the writing of the poem, and I've mentioned Lowe's Road to Xanadu, which is a really textbook job on doing just this. But the reason I gave, tried to give you some idea of how poet works with this material is actually that I think most of you is potentially, let's say, coming more into the world of poetry, and part of, if you write poems at all, part of what will get you out of the awful business of it becomes an awful business just to write poems, is that you start, instead of showing your ability, showing your responses, or going on your responses instead of your abilities. And your real abilities you will find along the lines when you're things to respond to. But then I also wanted to give you that gruesome little story. Another aftermath, so every time I wake up from one of these things, next day I think, oh my goodness, what absolutely terrible leads I gave them. It sounded as a little as if this were, as a matter of fact, Ellen Tolman's eyes were glittering. She was thinking of gossip and old birthday days and how dull it is in Vancouver. And she kept asking me, well, how can we arrange one of these snake pits here? Well, I didn't mean that there should be a snake pit. But I did mean, though, that quite seriously. Quite seriously, I meant that if you do, I meant two things. I wish you all, I want to think of you all as getting more involved in seriously in writing a poem, like great big grown-up people do come to write poems. And at the same time, I want to say, if you do, and come into the life in poetry itself, there, or come into this place where experience is paramount, whether you work with it in the sense of a poem or not, the experience that I was talking about with Dewey's term suffering and undergoing, then you do come, and all people have always come, in order to come to deeper experience, to some kind of period of actual suffering and actual blackness, unhappiness. If you wonder why, you only have to figure out that you really start out knowing practically nothing. And your most vital period and filled with yearnings and so forth is in your 20s. If you reach life satisfactions immediately, if you can make terms with life to have immediate satisfaction, then you never come, or you can seek realms of experience that aren't deals with. You have to postpone all the ends and ask for fullness instead of for rewards. And then so see fullness that it means some kind of sum total that's going to be the end of things. And then when you start that, there is going to be part of why I told those little bits about the medieval scenes, is not only to try to give you an idea of what magic was like, and that's only one particular way of writing poetry, but also to give you an idea that when you intensify experience, it does have sometimes tragic consequences. You do have the ravages of experience. And so when you read poets talking about, I'm reading St. John of Paris at the present time, and in it, for instance, people have claws of an eagle or a falcon frequently in their bodies, ripping at them like Prometheus did, forgetting the fire at their very vitals. And this is also one of the costs of extreme realizations in experience. It isn't the final one. However, I really didn't mean exactly a prescription, though, of course, I'm carried away eagerly and gives the impression it is a prescription. And I was a little dismayed the next morning. As I said, I was asked, could Vancouver have its own snake pit? The snake, whatever your own snake pit. Now I am going to read the Kulele thing. And I think, by the way, since I talked about that, let's say that is also called in alchemy, this is called the black. And at Black Mountain, for instance, Charles Olson, as part of the pedagogy of Black Mountain, really preached the black. He is a devout Jungian and really believed in it, that to enter any depth of experience, you would have to go through and find something that would be the equivalent of the alchemical process. And part of that would be to have to plunge into the very depth of what was your own despair. And so he did have the rather fiendish view of trying to, of really looking at any student, a young writer, to see if he could undermine them, to see if he could plunge them into their despair. Well, I can't reflect negatively on this because the two people that I know where something rather terrible happened were people with real potentialities of poets, and it may have only been their own course as poets. But let's say two of the students this semester, and I only had six students in this class, two of them are in the insane asylum at the present time, and this is not a humorous thing. They're one could see it in their poetry, and you really couldn't stop it because the things that became active. You have only to read the volume on Jung's on psychology and alchemy, and you will see how something of what the negrito is. And this idea of the black was in the back of my mind when I did write this at the end of the last session. It asked me about if I would read this structure of Rhyme 7 on page 20. And that will close our discussion. We'll get off content and get back to just structure tonight. I'll try to stay away from interesting little stories. But that, of course, is not going to help. But that is what he asked me, what Black Steam Lele was. And for the part of the thing you wouldn't have to know at all, you could certainly recognize he's African, and it comes in part that he really is some sort of fetish god. He was in the Musée de l'Homme in Paris, which is just, I think I told you last time that if the British Museum about the only places where these gods and fetishes are shown as if they still were sort of objects instead of meaningful works of man's spirit. So that this almost overwhelming room, the room that Picasso and Braque first saw these objects, is just not the actual room, but I mean the collection, because it's been moved to since they saw this African stuff first through this new big museum of man, is crowded, absolutely crowded with so many African gods, and they're all just enormous presences. It's an extraordinary experience, and in all midst of all these, then this one absolutely seems overwhelming. And I jotted down a little notebook that he was Glele. I haven't found pictures of Glele, but he must exist because I found many of the other gods in that room. But on the other hand, he might have been a visitation in the midst of all those African things. Black King Glele dwells in the diabolical, a tranquil spirit of pure strength, an orb radiating the quiet pool, the black water, to the boundaries of his image. Solitary among demons, he appears to them to us demon. We have composed him over again of enlarged terror, claws, teeth, hair, eyes, mouth, broodings of flesh, corruptions of blood, pustulences, wounds, eruptions, horn, bone, gristle, calcification, scars. These are the counsels of the wood. Lie down, man, under love. The streams of the earth seek passage through you, tree that you are, toward a foliage that breaks at the boundaries of known things. The mazes of man are outfoldings of chaos. In the dance you turn from your steps, cross visibly to original mess. Messages of creative music, imprints, notes, chosen scales, lies, gestures. Look behind you, courageous traveler. You will see the path where you have never been. See, these are not your footsteps that fall from your feet. And I stand, stranger to tranquility, because I'm enamored of song, to sing to Glele the king as I would sing to relentless histories. I'm like the century's trees, give note to new leaves. I'm like the bird of the season, who strains his pipes. I'm like the fire that Heraclitus tells us is kindled in nature, quenched in nature. The rhyme falls in the outbreakings of speech, as the character falls in the act wherefrom life springs. Footfalls and noise that we do not hear, but see as a rose pushed up from the stem of our lungs. The kindled image remains that you call the rose. Glele, torn up from what we call suffering, answers, I am the rose. Now, I did make an error in reading this, except that the passage is not an entire error, because the passage, in the passage, there are a couple of tricky words that have double service. In the dance you turn from, your steps cross visibly. Until you reach the word visibly, all of those are monosyllables, and all of them can have a double service. Quite a few of them can have a double service in meeting. As if you turn from your own steps, there's no punctuation of music, because finally you're going to get the kind of trick that is, these are not, well, I mean, no, it's in that passage, your turn, and the change from original map to messages. I mean, I just meant that in reading it, I caught this, that I was not quite prepared to read that passage. And I don't think there's so much to explain in this. Galele was, in my mind, not then an African god, but since I think of any one of us as being a world man, and Africa as being one of the countries of ourselves, I'm not a person that, I get outraged by a race simply because I think we're all members of one species, so the Galele is the god of our species, and the and nations and race must be just really dispensed with, so you don't reach the real thing in poetry. Not by the time, for instance, when we know more about French poetry, when African poetry now in this century is translated into French and beginning to be translated into our own language, this means it's coming into our common share. And if we can see Galele, as I saw him in Musée de l'Homme, he's come in as much as anything else into your own world. Yes, you're right that if you could find a book where Galele was shown, the poem asks you to have seen him. But it also means that Galele is conceived of, not as sage in Dante, but as something of the under, some power of the underworld. He was a power of violence and a figure that was wounded almost everywhere and had things driven into him and had excrescences, so that he also gave the idea of diseases and pestilences. And then that comes back, then the effort of the poem is to say, but this too is wrong.
Was your parallelism there, and was an attempt to get the Kikuyu poetry and tribal parallelism, or was it just simply not didn't it have the African measures in mind there?
Oh, you mean the one about the century's tree or something, yeah?
Well, I am like.
Oh, no, I wasn't thinking that consciously, and Africa, I don't know whether that is.
Yeah, but it's an African tray.
But it's also a trait
of
several places. Although, the Councils of the Wood is a double play upon the actual woods of Africa and the wood of the cross, and meaning that they're one of the trees, and then the trees are finally there. That I was aware of enough there, I suppose. Okay, now we're going to make sure we won't have any new content. Now let's see if we had any. Does anybody have any questions for something you would particularly like me to discuss from a point of view of content, of technique? Anything that you would like me to analyze and if not, then I will just go at it and see what comes. Let me have a particular passage. I'm going to take a passage that I'm going to have to write on the board. For comparison, I guess I'll take I'll take one where we only have one level of tone leading, and then I'll show you. I realized that I couldn't find a passage in this book where I was doing more than carrying one vowel sound through to give one line. And I may find I'm wrong when I start to analyze. That'd be nice too. I analyzed the Morin's class, as I remember, in the beginning of the light book, here's you, in a way, and I don't want to do that passage. That's what's here.
Maybe there weren't enough people there. And
I'm just showing it. Well, in this one, I started out with a line that didn't come to me in my head, but was in a page I was reading from translation from Pindar. We won't go into the meaning of the line. I didn't understand the meaning, and that's why I took the line. And something appealed to me. And so you'll see that the excellence of this line is not mine. Mr. Bauer is, or Mr. Wake, here it is, one of those poets highly admired. But this really saddens me when this sort of thing happens, so that it was the kind of line I would have liked to have written and immediately wanted to start it out as a challenge in the poem. I started at the end of last time pointing out what I mean now here, and then I realized when I thought about it that I wasn't yet talking about the tone needing of vowels. Because actually what happens here, and we'll use the word rhyme now to specifically mean this kind of thing that we call a rhyme, light, bright sort of thing. And we can also use the traditional where it's somewhat like that, but just goes a little, that it's called a... It off rhyme, it means that it looks that it's like that, but the vowels slightly change.
Yeah.
Actually, I pay attention to vowels, so if I have to use another word, I'll think of it. But this is not what I mean by tone leading. But I see. And what I do then is actually in this poem, it was again in the next line. This is my line now, because this is what followed right away. Is God's death at the margin of thought. And this pattern is now reappears here. But and things have begun to be these. I read this line at the light foot, and that was my trouble in reading the line, because I read it as if this were bearing the stronger stress instead of the noun, and so syncopation has quite started yet, except of course we know that in the terms of the conventional idea where the rhyme would go is the kind of thing to say, because you expect it would be at the end or something. I mean, but here there is, because brightness begins. Because the relation of the sounds the same in margin and begins, but not the stress the stress here in this word, for instance, is heavier here. I think this is at least a two, and if there's a caesura here, and I think there is, we have, I mean, a juncture, we'll now say, not a caesura, because it's much more valuable. I won't mark the junctures between words. And the brightness begins, then. The brightness begins. This stress is a one, and this stress is a three, and this stress is a two for the whole line. You see, and then other stresses, the bright foot here, and the bright foot begins. This is probably a three again, like the gift. Now I'm trying to show you a pattern of stress which they don't deal with when they're making stress in a poem. But I'm trying to get something close to, I'm not a linguist and I don't have a trained ear in this way, but I do have to get somewhat the feel, at least so I get somewhat conscious, in order to work outside of, let's say, the convention of a metric that's automatic, to get this other metric in my ear, and that's the reason for casting the other thing out. And this one comes all the way down to a four, the bright foot here, as you bright foot here. This is probably goes up and I'm going to guess that this is probably another two. The brightness begins. I don't know, but I'm trying best to show you that it is not as simple as something that you can diagram like this. It actually is a series of and then when you and when you really locate these, I'm you're going to find me short of what can be done for accurately locating the stress systems, but you must begin to catch on that this also begins to be a significant pattern, you see. And these are really the critical stresses, and this, I put it as a high point. I can't decide whether it goes on the verb or not, right? But here's the brightness. No, I thought it went up in pitch here. What you've got, if you look in the linguistic analysis at the present time, is that it's so far ahead of poetic analysis of what's happening in a poem. They have just started at the University of California, thanks to Mr. Spicer, who's in the field of linguistics, to make linguistic studies of people reading poems. They've made a large study of one small poem, having five different poets read it. It's a poem by Miss Josephine Miles, and she reads it about five times. Five different poets read it. You heard James Broughton read here last year in the festival. He reads it, for instance, because he has a manneristic voice. And so that they also make a curve of kinds of voices. They had their English faculty, a good section of English faculty read it. They had a section of students that were in their freshman year meaning to study English, and a section of students in freshman year meaning to study engineering read it. And they had, an assortment of professors who were outside of the English. And then because they're Jack Spicer's spiteful, he has some members of the speech department read it. The speech department has a very strange method of reading poetry, which is called the actor's method. I'm reading St. John Paris for the present time, and he has quite a long section against this particular thing in poetry. But linguistically, the interesting thing is, of course, the actor's method becomes an unusual and mannered and artistic way of reading a poem. But they haven't got their results yet about this. They will, of course, when it's on a tape and you read it, then you really can begin to measure these things. And once they measure them, eventually, I think if people can face up to it, you will have some adequate idea of what it is actually going on in a poem for its measures. Now, you have to deal with some of these things because they're interplaying. You see, both of these run stress, that's what I started to say, it might have this, so that it would have something like the same stress, but the contour is different than the contour of a word. But when I talk about contour, I mean the different stress relationship of margin from begin. And this, you can't talk about any syllable in a poem being unstressed. This juncture is an unstressed area. Unstressed means you wouldn't hear it at all. The very vocality of anything is a degree of stress. We have overstresses, but they don't usually appear in poetry. They're like the difference between elevator operator and elevator operator. Ordinarily, but once you know they're there, you can begin to use them. And I do try sometimes to introduce them in poems. That those overstresses, or like he did it, not I. That's another overstress over the one that's around. Quick adulterous. Now, but you see, Fred, now this is very, now for instance, this is not a thought or made up thing because it seems to be an imprint of my own rhythm. Now, tone reading is beginning here, because you see these are not ordinate, now we're beginning, except the T is still present, and it isn't exactly but these things begin then to orchestrate this passage. Not only, I also pointed out that these then operate, it takes a long time. For instance, if a person's thinking about alliteration, they are usually making a systematic, they're often making a systematic development of the possibilities that are in the book. But I try at times to fight against it. I mean, it's for one thing, then the first thing we're familiar with in poetry, if poetry is introduced to us in the second or third grade, it's introduced in at this level. There always is my poetry a good deal of play within the line of elements that repeat. Like this brightness begins and the eye comes. And then this is begins to carry over. Now I want to give a later poem. And it's in the opening, of course, because the consciousness has a lot to do with this kind of, you're keyed up, and once I get it, I'm going to take the middle of something where it's a narrative passage, and then this whole thing would become much more, subtle and present at all, because here you really are preparing your own orchestration and your intense idea of the possibilities of what's going to happen. And for instance, the reason these are all possibilities of sound that are being projected, but also you see, you're on the content level without worrying what the content is. You are trying to get step, tread, and foot all going. Because you're rapidly sending out impulses yourself to see how much of that's usable for a poem. You want to find how much in these first lines can really be used, and the fact that so much gets used in the sound system is also the same process going on. Now here's one that just before I think if I can very quick and even see about what's in this, it's because just before I came up here. For a young poet who seems to be sort of in between groups that are studying, and I'm giving him private lessons. I was trying to show what tone leading was, and had given him an assignment of taking a line of a poem which he'd written, and then trying rapidly to use it in an entirely different way and pay attention to sound instead of thinking at all of what he thought he had to say or what he had to express. Now this poem on Osiris and Seth, a magazine is coming out at the present time. I really don't know what quality it's going to be exactly, except that I did sort of have a benediction of it. Charles, and it is called Seth, or Seth, and has a center around Gnostic ideas. And so they wrote and asked, would I send a poem? And I immediately was very excited about the possibility such a magazine would be, so I sat right down and wrote off this poem. And largely because I was really waiting for a poem that would, a magazine that would allow me to go along this line of thought. But this is the highest, you'll see right away that beginning this poem, I've got lots more of the potential sounds in first line going. Now, this nice bright light business, you see, it's so familiar. What do? You choose, you have to look, you have to go through your mind like you did as a child, moon, boom, boom, and try to get up some rhyme that's going to disturb your parents, or what do you do? But the thing is that you've got another process that's going on in your poetry, and that is discovering really the thing that you are talking about. And it furnishes its own vocabulary so that you really are familiar with your rhymes, with matices, with his colors, I mean, with his palettes. They do form a palette. And when we get to tone meeting of vowels, because this will still be a lot of rhymes that are playing, I will suggest that. This is like using a color scheme when you rhyme, because when you use the particle itself, and that's what Olson says to do, in that. He said, you must get down to the syllable in the projective verse. Well, I mean, phony means really down to this instead of to that bigger unit. It means that you can orchestrate, but at the same time, you have a much wider choice of words. As a matter of fact, your palate expands, and you're no longer capable of having a conscious color scheme. You have to depend on even intuitions that you can't quite locate for why a color that has not been figured out before will be the thing you want to use. Or if you use it, you have to pay attention to what color it is when another color comes with it, which is even more important. Now, I have to go through this whole passage before you'll see how darkness is within the dark. As Harry Petrobus. So I'm on and on. Now, I didn't have to read for the content of this at all. It was my immediate concern, and just the evening before I wrote the poem, Harry Jacobus Painter, who lived in Simpson Beach, as we did at that time, was coming home at 2 or 3 in the morning, and the car broke down, and he had to walk over the mountain, and he talked and came over in the morning afterwards for coffee and told us about these darknesses within the dark that were all along the road, and we discussed the fact that these were the trolls, really, that always were in stories of people who lived in the mountain areas. So I didn't have to look for any of the words. They just now some of these words were my special poetic words, members. More and more, because I was thinking of, well, if you think of the total poem as an organism, all the words become members of it, and then all through, in the opening of the field, I begin to think of us, let's say, as members of mankind or members of Adam, things that belong to some large part or members of the universe, sort of thing. So that's a word I would tend to use all the time. Now I want to show you just, all right. This is tone leading here. Osiris, remember the one life, both are, that rides against chaos into the night, goes driving back to the darkness, is within the dark, and Harry Jacobus on a mountain, falls to the underground. Now, there's no accident that disappears. That simply sets up. But the complexity is, of course, that we've also got another system going through right away, that members. Unlike all are the end of the night goes dark, the rise against chaos goes dark. That's just kind of a turn and wasn't used. Doesn't really reappear until it's gotten something more in them. And that, now for instance, this sort of a pattern, it is a pattern in the beginning, set members of one life for dark, but it is not used until we really see that this is an accidental possibility later. Well, this is developed. You know right away if something's going like this. When you're writing it, you can't miss it. But here's the other thing. Now if we take the O sound of both, we find that it is developed all the way through. You got that. The Harry Jacobus before and pro. And so that there I think there are only two, as I remember. There are only two. There were three, for instance, that started moving at the beginning. And that's the I and the S and the O started moving at the beginning. But this, past this point, this is a little tiny development, because it really is an organization. It's one that you find frequently in Elliot. Or much more jazzed up and made obvious, but it's a thing I've learned that pleases me particularly, that this is set in the members right close on. But this is my maximum, I think, is two that are actually developed in the passage, and this is the only thing I could find. So My impression is at the present time that at the time I was writing Milton in the Field, the most I could do was develop a single vowel, a single line through, and maybe another one that would start later, because there are other sounds here that are going to start and go on below the poem. So that it isn't really until recently that I've been able to have two. And they do form, they form a kind of there are possibilities, at least, let's not worry about, there is a possibility of something like counterpoints if you can build up an expectancy of this sound, for instance, recurring, and then supply another sound, for instance, sound one against the other. And then there are aftertones that these things are sounding against anyway. So ordinarily listening to poetry who's read a lot of it, here's our O, for instance, it was the beginning sound, not way over there. And then I, and it's all in those tires, and it's in syncopate in the one line.
What? Did you do this in the last time you did it in the middle?
What page is that, Frank?
Seven.
All
right.
It's got a lot of the MMs, isn't it?
The mind and the mind.
Well,
and the heart and the pasture and the soul.
Well, yes, but I'm not so sure about. You see, where it is a highly organized activity, it usually primitive and meadow are the important words to me, and there are an alliteration that binds them together in that open one, and that reoccurs in the made up and mind and made and so forth, and mind and then goes away. But in the vowel sense, what struck me about this is, you see, that this very word of Cyrus, which is centered to the poem, and it's not a very long one, provides the two, and the lead provides the two. The two things that are going to be orchestrated through the opening lines, and in a poem like this is it'll be happening here, but not as high as developed. This is as far as I know, that my poetry's gone with this sort of thing, and actually isn't a matter of concentration, although it makes possible, of course, the concentration of the poem in some area. Now you obviously don't want to, what's going to happen if you have this going all the way through a poem? It is not a desirable thing because as a matter of fact, it doesn't. But it keeps the hearer right away, or yourself in writing right away, to the poem being musical. It takes the place. We're all familiar that if you got to, although it isn't a lot of development for me, you could get with Swinburnian sort of thing if you've got it. But of course, you can't get too thick because it's actually in another kind of texture. And it is not happening over and over again on the same stresses. Yeah. It doesn't have a regular stress, artificial stress pattern in which it's happening.
Yeah, the O is also in
line.
What? The O is in line four now. There is also the same O.
Yes, those darknesses and these things, you know, you really don't have, as you begin to notice them, they increase, and they become more available, and then you also have to notice what you're doing, or they take over. You have to notice just as much to quiet them back, in case they override. Actually, here, the structures and so forth are all in balance. But
you may already have dealt with this, and I'm sorry if you have, you can just wipe it out and tell me afterwards. Do you associate certain sound or progression of the sound with your mood in the poem, or do you just feel that the sound is entirely irrelevant to emotional context?
Well, I don't think there is any emotional context except sound in a poem. Last time I did discuss this, but I could reiterate it. What I feel when I am to write a poem is not a mood, or not an emotion, but a body tone, and I have to work with something that is impossible to I get to a place where I cannot actually talk and blab off, you know, and then I know really something has to be dealt with, and it's a dealing with things, and it's not an emotion or a mood. But the sound takes on, and the poem will take on, various moods and emotions and emotional tones, but they're in the poem as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, but I mean, it's quite possible, in other words, that later reflecting on your sound progressions, you might find the sound going off and see a particular significant emotion in terms of that.
No, I don't think it's, for instance, it's, oh, or the thought having an emotional feeling.
Not that that one, and you never feel
no,
that.
No, I don't. I mean, I think this Rimbaud, for instance, had an idea of sounds having this. I don't deal with sounds on the magic level. When we discussed magic last time, the magic that I, because I'm interested in magic and a poem, but I don't think the sound does. And yet, if you're not acquainted with it, this is one of the major traditions in poetry has been that, that sounds do have a magic. But you see, for me, it's sound structure.
Yeah.
And it's,
what about the close to O sound? Do they affect you like or in two and
awful. Yeah, this is O and O. This is a related sound. All right, that's true.
And what in mountain? On our mountain.
Yeah, this, although I really, actually, of course, when you're keeping the sound, and that one I was imagining, you would get this. You would get this into your office pattern. But I couldn't even analyze it now. It is really a kind of drudgery to get through, at least for me. It's very hard to get my ear, and I'm so scared of getting it wrong. And for all of the fact that I understand the wrong doesn't mean anything, you've got to get it the way you get it if you're going to do it. I still feel as if I were, you know, somebody is giving me one of those bloody tests. And I might say, this is the, and somebody can, that wasn't what, yeah.
I have a question to that story. What about back and dark and mountain and underground? The sound, is there...
Well, the and are not really as closely related as are not close enough to my ear related. Their dissimilarities greater than the other. It is true that this aw and the o are very close. They have some, they're quite close. There are two things to do with this. You've got to listen, and that's hard enough for your own voice, but you've also got to feel it inside your mouth where it is. And that I find awfully difficult. There's a nice little diagram that is in the mimeograph copy, and I was going to send that to Warren, except that you see, the diagram doesn't mean a thing. You're really supposed to make the sound and feel it. But this is also, I think, important in building up your actual working ability, because the play of your mouth, the imaginary play of these sounds in your mouth, also has something to do with the dance that you feel in a passage. And when we read, even though we have not practiced where these sounds in our mouths are, Empson is the person, by the way, who actually is the only place I found this mentioned. It's in a book of Empson's that I read years ago. I guess it must be the Seven Types of Ambiguity, because it's the only one I've read. And he is the one who invents the interesting point of the fact that the dance, there may be a dance in the poem, which is an actual physical dance of the whole vocal apparatus, the pleasure it takes in talking anyway, the physical pleasure, that it rehearses when it's going through something like this. So you can't locate where the dance is, but your mouth and all the musculature that is used to vocalizing, and it does increase as you vocalize. Well, now, of course, in the interest of that conscious poem, and that's what we're dealing with when we're going to want to know something about structure, it is in order then consciously to have these areas of your mouth become conscious instead of give them a permission to be aware in the poem instead of letting their life only exist if it be unconscious. Some people, of course, if it's conscious, can't even talk, since these are usually automatic levels and movement of muscles. And I find it very difficult having conscious, yeah.
Back and dark,
seem to be
the continent then.
The cup, yes. What happened to the mountain that you were thinking of?
Well,
the burn, yes, you're right here. These are both, the cup, identical, and the burn, are really related sounds. Yeah. We haven't even gone through here to look at consonants. and there are some that are so closely related, they really do have an immediate effect in this. Let's look at it as consonants in there. Osiris and Seth, members of one lifeboat, are that rise against chaos. Their essence running through there, and but the S's are like the U's of the and so forth. They actually are a almost constant thing that's there, and sometimes you have to restrain them. Sometimes you really do have to prevent them from kissing, especially if you've got lots of pearls. But these terminals, especially, I would say, you see, and when I read that line, Osiris and Set, members of one lifeboat are, this has a junction, as if it had been a comma, and this one has a juncture, this one has the regular word juncture, but we have a peculiar feeling of it. We have to make the juncture between a word like boat and somewhat larger. Let's make this a two, because that's the one we use for reshuffle, whereby when a thing's read aloud, you know that it's a phrase, not just the juncture between words. Oh, those who weren't here, you weren't here last time, the juncture between words is the one where you, instead of hearing Osiris and Set altogether, you hear Osiris and Set, and there are minute junctures we make in order. Because we have the possibility, like Joyce did in Finnegan, or Joyce did in Ulysses in part, of running words together like the Germans do, and running them together. Americans are hard for some people to understand because things come in such bursts that these junctures are so small that somebody's not familiar with all of the particles do hear them very much as well. But Americans hear them as individual words, and that's what's important, so we know a junction is there. And there, however, when we come to something like boat and are, we don't have the possibility that the French have of saying boats are. And so we have a slightly larger junction. Now you can see that those two are related. Those keys. Structurally. So the T and the B and the D are all in a very close area of consonant activity, and that's where you would get, that's where we, now, of course, what's also important here is that while I have noticed this and studied it, I've not noticed what Elliot pointed out, and this would be an area then where my activity is unconscious, and where it isn't likely I'm going to build up a coherent melodic pattern. I mean, it is going to be intuitive or something, but I'm not going to be really able to have words come to me because of these consonants. If I worked with them actually more and more, I think they would come, they would serve in order.
Pretty good.
Well, they come to you anyway, but...
And the MN too. Of course, these consonantal similarities are less intrusive anyway than vowel similarities, aren't they? Maybe that's why the...
Well, you think how immediate to our sense in a form that any alliteration is, and of course here, I mean, if it comes in the same sort of structure, an alliteration is quite
alliteration is mechanical. You're coming to the end of the word.
Yeah.
You pick up the I.
Yes. But in the middle, yes. Because here you have
Robert, before the this play. It seems to me that in a sense we're overdoing it, that is that a pattern of words are going to give up so many sounds.
Oh, well then let's take another pattern.
What I'm wondering is, when you say tone reading, are you moving ahead with the expectation of a recurrence
good,
of a
good.
Sound?
Oh, good, okay. Now this structure really is filled with possibilities of leading through, and then there are possibilities later of echoes. When you're right, this is the other thing, of course, this conscious, because when I'm writing, these sounds are kept, in a sense, so that when I come to lifeboat, I feel the structure. I really do then recognize what's usable, and this is leading through, and this is leading through, and that leads back to these words. Now, the first word in here that seems to be called up that's unusual is the word rise. It rides against chaos because it's not exactly the verb that would be called for the boat. It's got a reason. Let's say we could find out why somebody who's seen heroes riding on their horses forward to save the farmer's daughter and so forth would say rise. But the lifeboat, and the lifeboat is in the Egyptian, in the thing this is about, the lifeboat with the devil as the prop and the Christ figure as the as the dead god that it's carrying, or the one that's the rising sun. But the interesting thing in Egypt is that the Thet, this enemy, so-called Osiris, has all that mixture of things because he's at the very prow of the boat and mixes up with the darkness. And he's knowing what he really is. Well, we're going to see. Okay. This word was not right there. This word, and this word, of course, is in this series of Ra, Osiris, lifeboat, rise against chaos, and made out of the rise against chaos something much closer to the American feeling of the hero's venture, which is you're going to ride out against them bandits. And or in the night go, drive you back. And then I really came home to that mountain and still another thing. Now what I always find fascinating about this is that I did. Now let's have to hear then those darknesses within the dark. This is one thought, and it all belongs to one context, but it did have another little context that came in hidden because it was possible as the word rise was called up out of this out of the melodic passages. When I came down here, how did I remember or put into its place that Harry Jacobus's seeing the trolls on the mountain, the darknesses within the dark? When I wrote those darknesses within the dark, I was already thinking of that, but it was prepared by the fact that Hera Jacobus would be the last of the chaos boat and so forth. Sound structure. Now this is not the same as sounds having meaning or some particular thing, but along all the possibilities that you have within a particular area of sound, sometimes have little turns that call up to your mind. So it acts in a way to fish in the thing called the unconscious and call into being the thing that belongs to an order of sound. And most of these sounds I've used so many times in poems. Sometimes I think, well, now Robert Duncan really should leave night and light alone, except they are fundamental to the universe for me. So what am I going to do, you know? But if somebody said, you know, there are cynics in San Francisco, and they have a way of trying to say, well, if he can't get out of a poem any other way, he always could put dance into it. So there is a fact that you are in a risky business of what are you going to do. You really don't quite know. And my strongest poems, the ones I feel strongest, are the ones who use my most, I would think, tired and overdone material. I try every year on the first of the year to resolve that I'll not really introduce cross eyes in again, and I will. But every time it comes to a real crisis, there I go, winding up the form. But that's because it's a form to be done. Yes.
In your illustration of your rule about inversion, the relation by antithesis in the rise, the next word, driving back.
Mm-hmm.
The rise, the same letter, but with a D pulled out of the beginning.
What is this rule about antithesis?
Well, I mean, on this next week, you wrote just that the relation of sound can be done by breathing.
Oh, yeah,
Right.
I see. I thought maybe this was a rule someplace. I hadn't heard. it's one of those possibilities. This sort of thing that makes the O come here and come in the second position there and hit first here, and that is sort of in the rise and the drive, because all the D is a little different in its activity. They still are things that you feel. You do feel it. You know, I hadn't even thought of that. That's quite true that these tend to play around.
Well, this may not be true, but is this a tendency of yours, as in the second line of your first quote there, something that you hadn't marked, but God and thought have the same sound, do they not? God's
a God like both of them.
Now, this is what I want to get at.
They're near, but they really do, yeah.
The DT is what I'm interested in. That one is God thought. Mm-hmm. On D to T. And I noticed at the last one, trolls of the underground, you go from T to D and contain those.
I want to point out one thing about D's and T's. These are similar because they begin a syllable, but God's step has no place in which to explode and is really stopped instead of being exploded by the S. And this becomes significantly different when it's stopped. It makes a great deal of difference with the D's and T's in the terminals of whether they're exploded or not, or whether they are. Now, what is the technical term in linguistics for this? You see, there's two sides to a consonant, like D and T, and the T is voiced, and so if it comes in a terminal position, the God wouldn't be any different in a terminal position, you see, but if the T in the terminal position is significantly different from the D, because it's exploded, as they kept it closed.
Well, I'm still driving in something. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten to it yet. Where I see it most distinctly is there is a kind of juncture between adulterous and tread. That is, you don't say adulterous tread.
Oh, yes, this is a juncture, this thing.
Well, now what I'm getting at is this. Tread at the heart. That contains the T at the heart.
Oh, yeah.
The
yeah, yeah. That certainly is a
claim. But I don't think I'm getting my point across.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you have some kind of a principle there of containing phrases, as it were, with a similar opening and closing, like trolls and underground, and tread heart.
Yeah.
Is there any containing principle there, or is it just
ordinary? No, I must have got something because I've got there's a poem in this. And this, the one about go, where I did actually consciously use this sort of thing for a way of developing a line and a quartering it in certain sections there in order to give it a certain little. And that is on page 48 of this. When you come to, I'm not sure, I think the first place where the possibility showed up for me, as I was saying, it's the question. Now, the principle of form in the question is that I used to quatrain, and since the quatrain is a thoroughly expected form, I felt I could do anything, you know. A line of a quatrain could be 2 miles long, and you immediately know it was a 2 mile long line of a quatrain because we all take the quatrain for granted. So you can see all the departures. In other words, this is a poem written in a conventional form. And what the convention really permits me to do then is to have everything that I do in the poem be related to the conventional and be a departure. Well, now, with the line in Cusco, llamas of solid gold in the Inti Pampa, the llama pampa suddenly really gave me the idea of what I do in the line that follows. It becomes two further than that, rounded or at fort knox impounded. Now, while that was changed in the field to rounded or impounded at Fort Knox, the development on from that was changed and was kept. And when you come to the next quatrain as third line, you have to need man's common nature needs. Now, this is the thing I found pleasing in Eliot. It was part of Eliot's ragtime sort of rhythm and something. And he had something like this. Now, I don't really remember exactly where it is, but he uses full rhymes in a very... In a way that shows that they're sort of common stuff of poetry, and you have, like in Coleridge, a feeling that a feeling of bluntness. At least that's the feeling I have in a line like "Meet Mankind's Nature Deed." But it's advancing the conscious. I think there was this pattern in the word that right there became a usable and conscious element of composition.
It is similar. Hardy's got a line. Draws rain and sings to the swing of the tide. It draws, it ends up in the V, it's enclosed within the V sound.
I wouldn't tend to recognize this sort of thing, and it might be operating. Well, at least let's make the observation that some of these things then are elements of actual composition. Those are the ones that I spoke of as my using, and others show up. And when I begin to recognize them, for instance, there were things you found, when I begin to recognize them myself, when I'm doing them, they begin. Then my compositional part, the possibilities increase. You see, if I actually can recognize this when it's happening, Sometimes I don't have to be quite so redundant about my, I begin to feel form in an area where before the feeling of form was vaguer. And I can also relate that form to another place because I've now got a new thing, new possibility of relations of words, and I've got an expanded possibility in vocabulary. As I said, a wider palette of things that can be used. This looks like I was really operating at a high voltage, but we only have to look at how little actually I was conscious of using and working with, and how much there is in a thing like this that I wasn't working with, that I was not yet working with. So that it's when you want to say more that you have to open up these things. It's really rather sickening when a poet wants to say less and has all of them going. There are some poets where it's especially it's one of the ludicrous things of Edgar Allan Poe that there is enough sound system going for the thing to be absolutely loaded, and then we all grin at something terribly resounding, and then we see that the resounding is a banality. So that the other portion of this, we can't separate by the then you said something about it, sound, meaning, or what. The sound is intimate to the meaning, because if we set up such a system of this, and we do not have such a system of content, that really, if for instance Osiris and Lightfoot weren't significant in relation to Osiris, we'd have a certain, or I would certainly have a certain disappointment, and a certain feeling, for instance, that I didn't have to pay attention any longer and could just be soothed by these sounds. And then if rise doesn't, and chaos, you see, the two words here, look, it's Osiris, Lightfoot, rise, chaos, night goes. If that set weren't really related immediately to my whole feeling of what form means, if they weren't meaningful, the heart of meaning of the poem, then the pleasure of the poem would increase over the content, and you get the kind of thing. Of course, the poem does come to ludicrous, but let's take something like the kind of poetry where you feel the pleasure and hardly and lose the content, like in Swinburne. And actually, Poe only becomes ludicrous because he has some very violent, he has places where the rhyme falls where it actually is just as empty as it can be, and where the important word is long lost in the structure. I mean, just the important word of the sentence, because it's the function of the sentence that I'm also watching as I'm watching this part of the structure. Now, I'm going to erase this and take some line measures.
What was this onomatopoeia? I got it, but you don't worry about it.
I just don't understand it. I mean, I've read about it, onomatopoeia and so forth, and I don't seem to have any aptitude for it. Now, I sometimes recognize it when it's in poem, but I don't tend to pay much attention to it. Well, what were you thinking of?
Well, Sitwell, in that introduction, goes to fantastic length, the word Sid came good imagination, with down the mean. And I was just wondering if you had any ideas of that.
Oh, I have some ideas that come close to ones that Sitwell has and close to ones that Dobby has, and then I sometimes feel things are rough and hairy and vowel sounds. That seems to be a truth. There are textual feelings. My feeling of the structure of a poem, it is in some way a feeling of certain of certain things being lax, certain things being tense, certain things being hard and resistant, and other things being fluid and so forth. And that one I can't explain, but I thought you meant where the sound really seems to be the experience itself. And then I get very troubled if I start thinking about that.
Well, I must admit that I think about it. I mean, it's really all wrong, and bad way of reading the poem, but when I see the age, the dog, age of O, is in the toga, storm on our mountain, a mist
of
the crawls of the underground, I'm going right down.
Yeah.
So this right me or wrong.
I can understand when you talk. I mean, I just get troubled myself when I were writing the poem. I think I have something appealing you're talking about, and this would be that. don't know why I think that other word is. The fact that these begin to get, seem to be getting, the dark, the even dark,
yeah,
suggests
dark,
they're dark, and the ovis and the under.
It needs to be varied by the sharpness occasionally, otherwise it becomes ridiculous, like an air and prose.
In terms of what you're talking about, on page 38, the first line of that poem, The Gate, doesn't this also
Page 38
of the opening of the field, the O Lords of Intensity initiates a catastrophe. It seems to me that your eyes and O's and your T's is this tone leading now there?
The tones are in this, and I think it is a percussive in shape, and there are a lot of percussives in that, and the contour means a lot of that. Intensity and catastrophe, initiate. You see, those words all have a play that's set. The great role of a monosyllable in poetry, and if you the last person that I know of who, as far as I'm concerned, was able to write a sonnet at all is Yeats. And in one of the sonnets of Yeats, he has a line that is entirely monosyllables, and they're all active, and that means you do not know where to place the stress. You see, ordinarily a sonnet gets its life from the fact that there is no grid, and the life disappears if somebody reads it according to that grid that it's supposed to. But it is in principle. It is either 10 syllables long or 5 stresses. And then, of course, it can be both at certain times. Well, now, one thing to do that Yeats does, and it is dazzling, I can't remember which sonnet it is, but it was one of the, I looked everywhere else to try to find the sonnet, was to present it this. And I don't usually use it, so I don't have this one of Yeats's located in my mind. If you have 10 monosyllables in the line of the sonnet, by the way, something like, of one lifeboat, this is not a monosyllabic phrase, because of one is not a monosyllable. We have a very definite thing we do with the word of. And this really amounts in the structure to a double. It's got less distinction here, but the main thing is, that both of these words become, like in the field or something like that, become so governed in stress it does not amount to 3 different words. We have just one, really one pattern. That's why a poem filled with of this or in this begins to repeat over and over again one little set pattern. Now in this poem of Yeats, they really are monosyllables, so that means you really don't know where to place these stresses. It just becomes arbitrary in a whole series of ways of reading the sonnet. This gives a great life, and it gives a great puzzle of when you come to this particular line. Now, a word like, the reason I brought it up or came to my mind is that words like intensity and initiates and catastrophe, of course, are really large units of the poem that are already organized. And instead of having a freedom of shifting and changing stresses, you are really then stress bound in this area. You're using quite a large block in the poem by the time you have a word like catastrophe, where its pattern is exactly set, and the possibility of another word influencing it disappears. It becomes very minor indeed. And so these begin to clash against each other. These three right there in that particular, laws of intensity, initiatives of catastrophe. And that is part of that, of the thing that goes on there.
But you don't think of it as the same as this?
No.
You didn't get
no, it. Because I think of the tone leading part being the vowel relations here. Mm-hmm. And these consonant things are another kind of happening in the poem. I think of them as copies of the
Well, the O and Lord and catastrophe.
Catastrophe.
Yeah. O and O.
Oh, it sure
could be.
Intensity and initiation.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't go O,
E,
O.
Well, that could be hiding that line, but I'm not going to contradict you at all. Let's go through here and see what does happen in the poem. Because part of what, when you have leading, you find a pattern down here. As I said, this one didn't turn out to be really tone leading because it didn't go on. And so, O Lords of Intensity, initiative catastrophe, the star observed by Tycho Brahe in 1572, visible in bright daylight, the star recorded by Chinese astronomers in the year 1054, the star of our Lord. Into the Holocaust, the feeling the ravenous spirit sends out its hunters. My feeling is that this is not, it doesn't build up a community.